Years ago, you really wouldn't be mean and beat someone up, would you, Melissa? Okay. In Sunday school, Melissa says she's going to start beating people up that don't, people who don't tithe, they're going to start getting beat up. I don't know what she means by that. We were talking about John Wesley and the fights they got in. And she said, I could beat someone up. Kind of threw me. Years ago, there was a play written, and the play, it was a book, a story, and it became a Broadway hit, and it became a movie, and it was huge, and it was all centered around this young peasant girl named Eliza Doolittle, and she was nothing special about her. She's simple. She was born and raised on the other side of the tracks. She didn't have much money. She didn't have much couth. She wasn't very educated, but she's just simple. And every day she'd go to work, and her job was just selling flowers after the opera, the play, or whatever event was taking place. And one night she's selling her flowers, and two men come out of the opera, and they stop and they talk to her, and in talking to her, they hear her dialect. And they realize that she is from that side of the tracks, right? And so these two men, they're both professors, both highly educated, and they're talking to each other. And the one guy, Henry Higgins is his name, and he makes a bet with his friend and says, I bet you that I can bring her under my wing, and I can teach her to talk correctly and to use proper dialect and proper grammar and turn her from this poor peasant girl into a duchess, or more into a fair lady, if you know what I mean. And so they made this deal, and Professor Higgins goes, talks to Eliza's father, and he agrees, and he has to pay her off, and she comes and lives there, and she begins learning how to speak with the proper dialect. You know, the rain and on the plain falls mainly in Spain, or whatever it goes. And Peter Piper, oh wait, that wasn't one. And so anyhow, she learns how to, and she, this story is about this transformation that takes place in her life as she no longer speaks or acts or thinks of herself as a poor peasant girl from the wrong side of the tracks. But she begins to see herself as a fair lady. And Henry Higgins begins to see her as a fair lady. And not only does Eliza Doolittle realize that she is more than what she's ever been, she also at some point in the play falls in love with Henry Higgins. And one night they're celebrating the fact that she could speak about the rain on the plain in Spain and all that, and her and Professor Higgins and they all start dancing. Well, after they dance, she goes back to her room and she just breaks out in song. I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night. I think the words are up there. Okay, that was more than enough. Yeah. Okay, so, and the reason why is because she was just had that moment where she was so overcome with joy that all she knew to do was to dance, to express her joy. So, I'm willing to bet that when you shared with one another that moment in your life where you just wanted to, it was so overcome that you just wanted to dance. Now, I'm also willing to bet none of you danced because you're like me, you can't dance anyhow, and we just proved it by doing the hokey pokey. Or two, you're like me and you think you're too cool to dance. Or three, you worry about if you dance what the people in the back pew gonna say about you, right? And so we don't dance on the outside, but we start dancing on the inside, right? So when was the moment for you? For me, it was when either one of the boys were born. Now at the Open Skies, I said it was when Zach was born because Connor's not here. And he's not here, so it was when Zach was born, right? Or on October 24th when Jill actually married me. I mean, I could go through. I didn't dance, but man, I wanted to break out and dance. What about Justin, when time you wanted to dance? I'm gonna give you a chance here, buddy, to score points with your wife. Don't blow it. I'm proud of you. Because I was worried for a second you were gonna tell me when Texas A&M beat Auburn yesterday. I was worried. Yeah, well, we don't want to know. So who else? Who else? Did anyone in here actually dance when they were joyful? Actually dance? Virginia? Anytime there's music. Virginia is one of those people. She just wakes up every morning and there's just joy, joy, joy down in her heart. A whole nother song, sorry. Now, last week I told you we were going to talk about King David dancing, right? And I told you we're going to tell a story about a time when David didn't know what else to do. He was so overcome with joy, but more than that, he was so transformed that he had to dance, and that's what he did. Now, to understand the story, we got to back up a little bit. You got to know a little bit of the history. David was a newly chosen king, newly anointed. And one of the first things David did as king is he went into Jerusalem and took the city back. The city of David. The city of the king. That which would become the capital of the Jewish faith. And then after that, he went to battle with the arch enemies of the Jewish folks, the Philistines, and he whooped them. And he thought, there's only one thing left to do, right, Andy? And that's to bring the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem. Now, this is the Ark of the Covenant, and leave that picture up for a little while, Levi. The Ark of the Covenant was the most sacred thing in the Jewish faith. Because what the people believed is in that Ark, the very presence of God resided. So whenever they saw the Ark, they knew God was with them. When they went through the wilderness, the ark went, they knew God was with them. This was sacred and holy ground. And God gave them very specific instructions on how to build it, what materials to use, how to treat it, what to put in it, and how to carry it. So David started this first celebration. He got 30,000 men, and they were going to have this big party, and they went to get the ark, and they brought the ark in, started coming into Jerusalem. Now, like I said, God gave them specific instructions how to carry it, and nowhere in the instructions did it say anything about a cart. But on this day, David decided he knew a little more than God, I guess, and so they put it on a cart. And the security detail is around it, and they're riding it in, right? And it hits a little mud patch, I guess, and the Ark of the Covenant begins to tilt. And this one security guy, Secret Service guy, sees it's tilting. His name is Uzzah. And he reaches out to protect it from falling, and he touches the Ark, and he is instantly killed. This freaks David out. Freaks out everybody around. And so they send the ark off to a Gentile's house, and it goes there, right? And that word gets back to David that really good things are happening to this household, right? God is blessing him right and left because they got the ark. And David says, I got to give me some of that. So this time he says, we're going to do this a little differently. And if you look in 2 Samuel, chapter 6, verse 13, you want to put that up there? We see that David brought the ark in the right way. Okay? Whenever those carrying the ark, go back to that other picture, Levi, can you for a second? Yeah. You see those poles? That's how they were to carry the ark. They were to have a priest on either end, and the poles were supposed to be on the shoulders of the priest. And they were to walk like that. Go back to the scripture, Levi, and go to the next one. And what the law said, what God said is, every so often, they were to offer a sacrifice. And David did. In fact, what Samuel tells us is every six steps. David didn't offer one sacrifice, he offered two. He killed an ox and he killed a calf. But he did. And now, for those of you who don't like the book of Leviticus, so for those of you who think the book of Leviticus is a waste of time, you don't have to read it because it's boring and it's old, let me tell you what. Book of Leviticus tells us that when you, the best way to honor God for the Jewish people were to, by making a sacrifice out of their wealth. So what David was doing in this is he was not only following what God wanted, honoring God. Book of Leviticus tells us a lot. In fact, when we finish, Melissa, studying about Methodists on October 9th, we'll finish that. On October 23rd, we're going to kick off a study, Jesus and Leviticus. And I'm doing it because I wanted to preach it, but Matt told me he'd quit if I preached the whole series on Leviticus. So I can teach it, but I can't preach it. So, because Leviticus would have been the first book Jesus memorized. Did you know that? And this is how important this is. Anyhow, side note. And so they honored God, and they followed the letter of the law out of respect and honoring what God wanted them to do. Then if you read the very next verse, 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 14, it tells us that David put on a loincloth and danced with all his might before the Lord. Now, I don't know what kind of dance David did. He might have done the hokey pokey. I don't know. He might have sat there and said, right foot in, right foot out, left foot in. But I know this. I know David actually did things so right that his only response was to dance. Because see, and if he did the hokey pokey, he especially did the last part. Because when David worshiped, he put his whole self into worship of God. And he said that's the only way to worship. There's no kind of worship. There's no a little worship. For David, worship was putting everything he had into it. And he was able to dance this time because he finally understood what it meant to be in the presence of God and what it meant to worship. See, if you read the Psalms, there's a group of Psalms that were Psalms of praise. They were used for call to worship as people were entering into the temple. And I'm just going to read some verses out of some of them. And I want you to see if you can pick up the common threads. Ready? We're going to read 97, 98, 95, 96, 98, and 100. 95, come let us sing out to the Lord. Let us raise a joyful shout to the rock of our salvation. Let's come before him with thanks. Let's shout songs of joy to him. Come, let's worship and bow down. Let's kneel before the Lord our maker. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Share the news of his saving work. Bow down to the Lord in his holy splendor. Tremble before him all the earth. Sing to the Lord a new song because he has done wonderful things. His own strong hand and his holy arm have won the victory. Shout triumphantly to the Lord all the earth. Be happy, rejoice, sing your praises. Shout triumphantly to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with celebration. Enter his gates with thanks. Enter his courtyards with praise. Thank him and bless him. Did you notice a couple of common threads through those psalms? And this is just a few. We could have read about another 20, and it still would have echoed the same thing. First off, whenever David used the word worship, you know, he used a very specific word. He used the word shakah. Say that with me. Shakah. A little better. Shakah. Shakah literally means to fall down or to bow down. So for David, the beginning of all worship is to fall down. In other words, to surrender. For David, worship began with a state of the heart. It had to be a heart that was willing to surrender. The reason why David could celebrate the second time is because he surrendered his will. The first time, he wanted to do things his way, right? He wanted to be the center. It was all about David. Everything revolved around David, what David wanted. The second time, when he did it right and no one died, because he let it be about God. It was about what God wanted, not what David wanted. He surrendered. And for David, that's when worship begins. But did you catch the other thing? There is not a passive word in those psalms. Every word is active. Sing, shout, dance, praise, bless. All these verbs of action. So for David, it starts with the heart, but then it has to do something, right? Whew. Man. Okay, tough crowd. Because for David, worship is not a spectator sport. We for some reason have made it that, but it's not. I often laugh, and Justin, I'm just gonna pick on you because I love you, man. Thump, thump, thump. But if Justin was at an Aggie game the same way we do worship, oh my gosh, people would spit on him. Right? Because at A&M, what do? No, you don't whoop. We don't whoop in church. Genesis 8, verse 43, thou shall not whoop. Look it up. But right, Justin, you stand, right? And you show a little bit of a you do something, right? You because that's what you do. And for David, you do something. And we've made worship a spectator sport. You grade the pastor and whatever, and you know what Richard Foster said? Richard Foster wrote this book, Celebration of Discipline, one of the best books ever written. And he says this: to worship is to change. To stand before the Holy One of eternity is to change. If worship does not change us, we have not worshiped. So if you're just going through the you're not worshiping. It is about change. It is about something happening inside to you and then expressing it somehow outside to you. Now, for the way you express it, it's all different. Some people clap, some people shout, some people sing, some people simply bow their heads, some people break the Bible and whoop. And some people even dance. And no matter how you express it on the outside, as long as you don't hurt the person sitting next to you, it's okay. As long as what happens on the outside is also happening on the inside. You know who Friedrich Nietzsche was? Friedrich Nietzsche was this atheist, right? And he one time said this. I want to get this right. You must look more redeemed if I am to believe in your Redeemer. Now, you know, I love you guys. There ain't a whole lot of redemption looking going on here, right? I mean, there's times where I'll joke with Matt, I just want to break out and yell, dead man walking, because you guys look like you're miserable. Granted, I'm not Joel Osteen, and I'm not the best, but this is about looking redeemed. right? We wonder why church people, like people outside the church, don't want to come to church. Is because we don't look like we're happy. Before I started running to make my wife happy, I used to tell her, why would you want to run? Everyone that's running, they look miserable, right? Well, I could say the same thing. Most people at church, they just look miserable. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to be joyful. And I understand not all of us can be filled with joy and laughter all the time because some of us are going through difficult times. I get it. It's hard, right? Because things don't always work out the way we want them to work out. Relationships that we count on just fall apart, right? People who we love die, and we grieve. And the grieving doesn't end after 6 months or a year or 2 years. It hurts. And sometimes we wonder how we're going to get through another day. We wonder how we're going to pay the bills. We get bad report on medical tests. We're just tired. We're just worn out. And the last thing we want to do is be joyful because we just don't feel the joy, right? I mean, that's who we are sometimes. And I don't want to cheapen that. And I don't want to patronize you. And I don't want to be cliche-ish. Because I get that way. I mean, I get that way. There's days where I don't feel joyful. There's Sunday mornings I don't feel joyful. You know, it's just sometimes life is hard. And sometimes it just beats us. But when that happens to me, this is what I try to do, and I wish I was more successful at it, but I'm not. I try to look past the moment that I'm living in, and I try to remember the real story of the Bible, because the real story of the Bible isn't about a God who wants to smote us, isn't about a legalistic God who counts our wrongdoings. It isn't about living this way or that way or following this or following that. The real story of the Bible is about a God who is head over heels in love with us. And his only desire is that we fall head over heels in love with him. The real story of the Bible is about this God who knows when we stand up and when we sit down, knows every thought and every word, even before we think it or before we speak it. But yet he still loves us. The real story of the Bible is about a God who says, no matter what you go through, I'm with you. The real story of the Bible is what Paul wrote, that I am convinced that nothing, not cancer, not death, not Alzheimer's, not dementia, not bad relationships, not divorce, not financial stress, nothing can ever separate us from the love of God that's in Christ Jesus. And I try to look past this moment and hold on to the real story of the Bible. And the real story of the Bible is about a God who says, there will be a day where you will be in a place where we'll all be together again, and there'll be no more pain, and there'll be no more suffering, and I will wipe away every tear from your eye. And I try to remember a God who says, I will make you whole, and I will heal you. And when I start remembering that, when I am able to wrap my head and my heart around that, that joylessness begins to just kind of melt away. Because I'm reminded of the good news that there is a person, there is a God who really does believe that I am the best of the best of the best. And when I remember that, I want to be like David. I want to be like Eliza. And I just want to sing. And I just want to dance. I could have danced all night. Because how else can we respond to the good news, the great news, Nietzsche one time said, you got to look redeemed if I'm going to believe in your Redeemer. We are redeemed. We are bought, we are paid for, and we are loved. And if that doesn't get you in the mood to worship, if that doesn't cause something to stir inside of you, if that doesn't get your feet moving, then you're not hearing the good news. I believe that's what David would tell you. I believe that's the gospel. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.